All right, good evening. All right, we're starting. Oh, hi, Michael. Good to see you. Okay, looking around, we've done this already for several years about profiles in persecution, where we've picked one or two, or I think in some years even three people. I'm not sure we ever discussed a unit like we are tonight. This story is not really about individuals. It's about a massacre that took place, and as I opened up, I realized this was about a week after Tisha B'Av. It seems, I didn't quite figure out the dates, but it seems that year Tisha B'Av fell out on Thursday. There was a Shabbos that had some disturbances, and then the massacre in Hebron. Well, first it sort of was in Yerushalayim on that Friday, and then the bulk of the people in Hebron were killed on the Shabbos following. So therefore, that would get you to Yud Tes Av, and the day is still observed in the Hebron Yeshiva today, which we'll get to, which is not in Hebron anymore. So that day is still observed as the Yahrzeit, and everybody still goes to Hebron. There still is activities there to recognize that. So when this story, I think, has a couple of different components. One is about the city of Hebron. Who was there? Why were they there? There is the British aspect to it. Just the general, or I should say, the British mandate aspect. I mean, how did this play out in terms of the political situation at the time and the drive for statehood? What was the goals of the various people? And perhaps it's known most in the more yeshiva circles as the attack that took place against the yeshiva of Hebron that had settled in the city of Hebron only 5 years earlier. And of those of the victims, it's interestingly enough, there were several that were American. In fact, one was from Philadelphia. There were several students from America that had gone to learn in Hebron in the yeshiva that was there, and they had roots in the various yeshivas in America, some from Yeshiva University, some from Skokie, from Torah Vadas, that had decided, the original Shana Aleph, right? They decided to spend a year or more learning in Israel, and they were still there. In fact, the period following Tisha B'Av in yeshivas is generally Bein Hazmanim. So it happened to be there a lot of people were not there at the time. Some of the Rebbeim as well were not there at the time, which may have been which saved their lives. There were probably more Americans because where are they going to go, right? They were stuck. They were there in yeshiva on that fateful day. So let's go back a little bit earlier. So some just sort of paint this as, all these people had all of a sudden shown up in Hebron, these Jews had shown up in Hebron, and that had built up some amount of anxiety amongst the Arab population there, and they and eventually they revolted on that day in 1929. So, first of all, there had been Jews living in Hebron at that point, going back several thousand years. I mean, it sounds like there had never been, at least the claims that I had seen around, I'm not sure if this is completely documented, but the Hebron had not had Jews. It sounds like since at least the time of Bayit Sheni. All right, during Bayit Sheni, they recognized Hebron in the Mishnayos, where they called that that's the place that's supposed to be lit up, potentially even before that. But Jews had not ceased to be there. Sometimes they were living under more difficulties than at other. Under some regimes was better than others. It had from the Muslims to the Christians to the Turks to the and then to the British. That was the transitions that took place. Some points it was a difficult place. There had been other massacres and pogroms and things like that that had taken place in Hebron previously, like 100 years previously and before and prior to that as well. But there had been a strong both Ashkenaz and Sephardi community there that had been there for centuries technically, but even not the Sephardic community had been there for centuries, and the Ashkenazi community had been there for over 100 years when the students of the Vilna Gaon came. Some of them decided to settle in Hebron. Those two communities actually, just from reading between the lines, didn't necessarily get along. They operated completely separate kehilos, separate shuls, separate mikvos, separate chevra kedishas, separate schools. Those two communities were separate. And in fact, that actually played a little bit of a role in the riots later on. The rabbi at the time was someone by the last name of Slonim, who was a Chabad chassid, who had been there. Rabbi Slonim was the Ashkenazi chief rabbi of Hebron, but you know, it seemed like being the chief rabbi in Hebron didn't just mean that you sat in Paskin Chayos all day. That also meant you were certainly involved in business. His son owned the bank in Hebron and therefore had strong relationships with many of the higher ups amongst the Arabs that lived there. And for that reason, they thought that they were maintaining a very good relationships. Now, the Ashkenazi community grew significantly in the aftermath of the arrival. And here we're going to sort of switch over to the other part, to the other narrative, with the arrival of the Hebron, what became known as the Hebron Yeshiva. When they were in Hebron, they were not known as the Hebron Yeshiva. They were known as the Yeshiva in Hebron, but the official name is Knesset Yisrael. That's the official name, and they were coming from the Slobodka Yeshiva in Slobodka, which was across the river from Kovna, essentially a suburb, like across a bridge. Half the year it was across the bridge, and half the year you had to float across, because apparently every spring, when the snow melted, the bridge got knocked down. So half the year until they were able to rebuild it a couple of weeks later. But anyway, so that's where and Slobodka was known at that time of, if not the top yeshiva, one of the top two or three yeshivas in Europe. You know, some of the Mir people might argue with it. Some of the Panovich people might argue with that. But Slobodka was understood to be the top yeshiva in Europe at the time. Many of the people that are responsible for the growth of Torah in America over the last century at this point, many of them learned there. Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, Rav Aaron Cutler, Rav Ruderman. I'm not sure actually in Yeshiva University, I'm not sure if any actually came from Slobodka. In addition to that, there was also a second yeshiva in Slobodka, which is known as the Yeshiva of Baruch Ber. So this is technically the first yeshiva, which was under the leadership. There was a Rosh Yeshiva of Rav Yosef, Rav Epstein. His name is slipping my mind here, but Rav Moshe Mordechai Epstein. He was the Rosh Yeshiva of the yeshiva of the Slobodka Yeshiva, and he was sort of placed there. The sort of the person running the show, or in charge of all the decisions that were made by the yeshiva, was the Alter of Slobodka, Rav Nassim Tzvi Finkel. So that name sounds familiar. We might be more familiar with the name that he was the Rosh Yeshiva of Mir, that passed away, at this point 6-7 years ago, I guess. He was a namesake. I believe he was a grandchild, if not grandchild, great-grandchild of the Alter of Slobodka. He was known as the Alter of Slobodka, sort of the father of this yeshiva. He was a Musarnik. He was a person who taught and was very in tune with his personal midos, and sought to imbue that within the yeshiva. So he trained all the members of the yeshiva. These are the midos we're going to work on. Some of the style of drushos that we see today, the idea of that all of the tzaddikim that we see in all the avos, Avraham, Yitzchak, Yaakov, all of them were tremendous, tremendous tzaddikim. Why were they punished for this? Oh, well, there's this little nakuda that they made a mistake with, etc. So that's a lot of that emanates from this from the Alter of Slobodka, and they and that was the top. If not necessarily the top, you know, amongst them, it was known as being the place where brilliant people went. People that went there would have to know, would be tested in hundreds of dafim, etc. All sorts of stories. This Alter of Slobodka, there's all sorts of stories of mind games that he used to play with the Talmidim. It's a very he probably deserves his own shir at some point. So Rav Epstein, who was the Rosh Yeshiva, he was sort of the Alter was sort of the Mashkiach. Sort of that's how you break it down. So at some point, Rav Epstein had to come to America. This was in, I think, 1921. He came to America to raise money. So nowadays, we often see Rosh Yeshiva from Eretz Yisrael coming to America to raise money. They come for a week or two, and then they go back. So in those days, it was not you came for a week or two. You came for a year or two, right? So you would come to America, and you would set up shop someplace, and you would go from town to town, and from dinner to dinner, and people all over the country potentially there'd be these organizations that formed in all of the different communities to raise money for the yeshiva, and it wasn't like you could zoom back shirim to your yeshiva in Europe. It meant you were in America for the year. So in theory, Rav Shimon Shkup, for example, came to America, I believe, officially to raise money, and he ended up being a Rebbe in Yeshiva University for a year or two while he was on his mission from the yeshiva in Europe. So Rav Epstein was in America raising money, and the Lithuanian government or the Russian government passed a law that pretty much removed a draft exemption from students in the yeshiva. So essentially, now the students in the yeshiva, while they thought till this point that they were exempt from the draft, now all of a sudden they were going to be obligated for the draft. With all the news of the last couple of days of these two Orthodox baseball players being drafted, so some have remarked, I thought the Gouda is going to make a protest against all these Orthodox Jews being drafted by the Major League Baseball league, right? So, anyways, that was so they found out that law was being passed, which would have affected only Russian citizens. The Slobodka Yeshiva at that point was an international institution, but that was a significant part of the student body. And it was already decided then that they were going to transplant the yeshiva, or at least move a portion of the yeshiva to Israel. Now, it is unclear. I'll just mention one of the sources. So I have a book here, which the Prince of the Torah Kingdom, which is a biography of Rav Simcha Zissel Breut. So he was the Rosh Yeshiva in the second half of the 20th century in Hebron. I think he passed away in 20. I'm not sure exactly when he passed away. But this has, first of all, amazing pictures in it, and some pictures of some people that before they had beards and things like that. But it also has a pretty detailed account of the growth of the Slobodka Yeshiva and its move to Israel. Now, I'm not sure I would take this as a historical record, but they decided at that point that they were going to take part of the yeshiva, move it to Hebron, and Rav Epstein, the Rosh Yeshiva, as well as the Alter of Slobodka, who came a little bit later, went and built this yeshiva in Israel. Now, why Hebron of all places? There's different versions of figuring out what I'm not sure which came first, the chicken or the egg kind of question, but the Hebron yeshiva was known for being was a Litvish place that we think of all these yeshivas as people wearing black, all black, and etc. So that was really a Hasidic invention. The idea that you go to Lakewood today and everybody's wearing black suits and everybody's wearing black hats, that's actually part of the Hasidic influence. In yeshivas like Slobodka, they dressed very fashionably. In fact, that's why some of the pictures in this book are a little a little awkward, right? You have people with interesting hairstyles, you have people with the fancy glasses, you have people wearing fashionable clothes, and when they showed up to Yerushalayim, while everybody was excited that one of the top Lithuanian yeshivas had shown up in Yerushalayim, there was some awkwardness with regards to, but are you going to change your clothes? Like we don't dress like that in Yerushalayim. Yerushalayim, the old yeshiva in Yerushalayim is long coats, a very traditional way of dress, and these guys showed up, and that's not the way that they dress. So either to avoid strife or they were told, it's unclear to me, I've heard different versions, they ended up saying, we're going to leave Yerushalayim and we'll go to Hebron, and that way we won't bother anybody. So that's why they built the building in Hebron. There was a sort of a ghetto in Hebron where many of the Jews owned homes. Other Jews were able to rent homes in the outskirts, but there was a specific place in Hebron where many of these people lived. That's where the yeshiva was. And they set up shop. So I think in 1924 officially is when they set up shop in Hebron. So that gives them 5 years until you get to 1929. It began attracting people, students from all over the world, certainly from Europe, and even as mentioned before, even from America, there were students that were able to head there. Which, you know, it's not like today. It meant, you know, traveling on a boat and traveling on donkey in some cases in order to get there, but that was what formed the yeshivas. The yeshiva had, I think, several hundred students in it. Again, we mentioned this was, we get to this period, it was during Bein Hazmanim, so there weren't as many that were there, but it was a significant place and had a dormitory and there was a sort of a foundation in America of people that were supporting it, and that was the yeshivas Knesset Yisrael in Hebron. So what now gets us, now that gets us to, I guess, 1928, 1929. So if you're here, I sort of switched over. I've had this book. I think I bought it at like one of these. An estate sale or something like that. I don't think I spend more than $2 or $3 on this book, but there's a book, One Palestine Complete, by someone named Tom Segev, who's written a lot on the Middle East. He's sort of trying to take a impartial perspective, but he does have an entire chapter in his One Palestine Complete, because this was before 1948, when everybody was living, Jews and Arabs were living together under one government. So the and neither side was happy about it, right? So they so there is a chapter here entitled Hebron 1929. So I read that whole chapter, which describes the activities really of those couple of days. But I realized, wait a second, what prompted this? How did we get all the way to this point where there was a pogrom in the city of Hebron, and why in Hebron? So I just went back to the previous chapter, and sort of there had been challenges. There had been as the yeshuv in Israel was beginning to grow with more and more Jews, their tensions had begun developing about who was going to get what land, and are the Jews going to force the Arabs out, or are the Arabs going to force the Jews out? And Israel already at that point, the Israelis, or the Jews already at that point, had begun cultivating some land, begun purchasing some land. There had been tensions already earlier, I think in 10 years or less earlier, really since the time actually of the Balfour Declaration, is when all of a sudden the Arabs there realized, hey, wait a second, these Jews are like, they mean business. They seem to be here to stay. And that led to, we'll say, tensions. So the things began in, or I guess you would, to really trace the period that led to the pogrom of 1929, you probably have to go back 10 months earlier to Yom Kippur. That one of the significant sites of tension was the Kotel. I don't know if I want to call it Kotel Plaza, but the space in front of the Kotel where Jews were at that time sort of permitted to daven, were permitted to go there. But any change to any status quo got everybody all tense and riled up, etc. So if the Jews would bring benches or chairs there, so all of a sudden they'd be like, oh, they're starting to build the shul there, and we have to, you know, the Jews are changing the status quo. And the British, who were, I guess, probably their main interest was to not get themselves killed, was their number one interest, and B, to, enrich themselves in some way, and maybe felt some altruism of, we're going to police this place, but probably the first two things were their highest priorities, right? Their biggest priority was to just keep everything quiet. It seems they always just felt like, well, if we could just keep everything as is and just appease who needs to be appeased, so everybody's going to be able to be quiet. So on September, things are going to stay quiet and everything will be okay. So on Yom Kippur, or Erev Yom Kippur, 10 months earlier, all of a sudden a mechitza essentially goes up at the Kotel in preparation for Yom Kippur, and that all of a sudden the Arabs go running to the British. Hey, what's going on here? The Jews are changing the status quo. They're trying to kick us out, and they call in the chief rabbi or the rabbi, you know, the gabbai of the area, and say, hey, what's going on here? You're not supposed to do it. He says, oh, just let it be for a little bit. We'll take it down. We'll take it down overnight. We won't take it. And then eventually they sort of left it up over Yom Kippur, and the Arabs came in and tried to rip it down, and there was fights that took place regarding the Kotel at that point. And that's where, and this is not the first time it had been tried, but the attempts, this is sort of where it became in earnest, the attempt by the Arab side, or the attempt by the clerics and those, and al-Husseini, the person who was sort of overseeing the mosque, or overseeing that area, where they, in order to rile up the Arabs, would make claims of, hey, the Jews are trying to blow up the Temple Mount, the Jews are trying to destroy the mosques, the Jews are trying to change whatever. And there, whether they actually believed it or not is doubtful. Whether Arabs believed it or not is less doubtful. I mean, some of them probably did believe, and that was used to rile up the members of their tribe, so to speak. And it was also used to coalesce power, meaning just as we see today, that sometimes when people when Arafat or Abbas, right, when they would see their power beginning to wane, so they would make up some claim about how the Jews are attempting to do this, that, or the other thing. Often they pull the same canard of the Jews are digging under the Temple Mount, the Jews are planning on blowing up the mosque, the Jews are planning this or that, and that was a way of sort of ignoring any of their internal problems, coalescing their political power, potentially also at the expense. There is an article on the City of Hebron website, I'm not sure, well, I guess the Hebron Foundation website, about their warring factions, and Husseini was using this as a way of showing how tough he was, that we're going to make sure that we're going to defend it, and even if it means that we have to defend it physically, and even if it means we have to make sacrifice, we have to make sure that we're able to maintain the Temple Mount, as we could see, which Sam Samuels is sitting in front of as we speak. Right? So negotiations then continued really through that year there were brief times of where there were some people that were beaten up. There were Arabs that sort of went into the Kotel area and started tearing things down, or pulling or breaking chairs, or tearing apart Sidurim. These things aren't supposed to be there. The Jews sometimes attempt to defend themselves. Sometimes they weren't able to defend themselves. Where the British stood in order to maintain peace or not was always ambiguous. How much they could be relied on to actually protect the Jewish people. And that tense situation continued throughout the year. Now, I didn't see anybody make any reflection on Tisha B'Av. Tisha B'Av did not, I don't know if anything happened on Tisha B'Av itself, but it seems like, I think the next day, on Friday, there was a boy that was killed. There was a Jewish boy that was killed. So there was sort of an attack on a boy, on a Jewish boy. He was who died eventually of his wounds. In retaliation, there was another fight where an Arab had suffered. He, before the Jewish person had died, the Sir Harry Charles Luke, who was the person who was overseeing the mandate at that time, he made some kind of comment about how I hope they both live or they both die, because otherwise this is going to lead to significant problems. I'm sorry, I made a mistake. So his funeral was on Thursday. Was the next day on Thursday, August 22nd. Oh, I'm sorry. So his funeral was on the Thursday, the day before. That was his. Um, sorry, it was all over the course of that week. So his funeral was on Thursday. His funeral was became one of these protest-type funerals where they chanted songs and they sang atikvah and all these kinds of things, which angered the Arabs. Not that there's any type of justification for this, but there were some fights that took place over the course of that day, and these things seemed to be settled until they got everyone was able to sort of get to sleep that night, which was Thursday night, although it was a very tense atmosphere. On Friday, however, and it's also unclear to me what kind of communications they have. It's not like you could send this out over WhatsApp or over Facebook. But somehow, the next morning, all of a sudden, thousands of Arabs began coming into Yerushalayim. They said, anyway, well, it's Friday, so we have to go pray at the mosque. But there were a lot more than usual. And there was some riling up of them at their services on Friday. We have to defend the Temple Mount. We can't let the Jews do this to us. They're attempting to banish us, etc. And as they left the Temple Mount, they started attacking Jews. So the first there is actually some dispute about who actually died first. They started chasing around a Jew in the Old City as they came off the Temple Mount, while seemingly sort of at the same time three Arabs somehow got killed in Mea Shearim, although it's unclear to me how they got killed or who killed them. Mea Shearim is not so far away. And that led to riots over the course of that day in Yerushalayim. Nothing yet really had happened in Hebron, although in Hebron there was rumors that had come out from Yerushalayim to Hebron informing the villagers there that dozens of Arabs had been killed by the Jews, which was not true. It was I think both sides were in the single digits. Everyone needs to come to Yerushalayim in order to defend the holy city. Now, in Hebron, there was the British representative who was supposed to be in charge of Hebron in order to keep the peace there and in charge of the police was someone by the name of Kafarada. Kafarada, actually, his picture is on the, I saw a picture of him, I believe it's on the, on one of the Wikipedia pages. So he was somewhat of a younger guy who showed up in Hebron only 2 or 3 weeks earlier. And that's part of the issue. He had not yet developed the relationships with all the people he really needed to develop relationships with. He'd only been there for a couple of weeks, and he had a police force that was under his control of about 40 people, although a bunch of them were older. This didn't sound like it was going to be a very, it wasn't like the British Army was there. These were people that lived in Hebron who were part of the police force. Only one of them was Jewish. He has a problem. He actually, as these Arabs in Hebron, which numbered in, I think, 3,000 or so was the population, so a couple hundred of them had gotten together to go into Yerushalayim, he stopped them by saying that, oh, you heard that all these Arabs have been killed. It's not true. No Arabs have been killed. So, which wasn't exactly true, but he was able to get them to all quiet down. So this is still Friday morning. As the day goes on, there was more and more rumors that were coming into town as to the fighting in Yerushalayim. Some people had left, but left Hebron to go to Yerushalayim, but most really had stayed. And this Kafarada, the person who was the British person in charge, he pretty much told everybody he got a hold of the two leaders, this Rabbi Slonim and the head of the Muslim. He said, "You guys have to keep it all. You guys have to keep it under wraps. Everybody needs to stay in their houses." He turned to the Arab leader, the Muslim leader, and says, "Can you keep everybody quiet?" And he said, "Well, actually, I can't because the word has come. The orders had come down from Husseini in Jerusalem, in Yerushalayim, that we better." That that we have to defend the honor of the Muslims, and if we disobey that, there's going to be major fines against us, so I can't publicly get everybody to quiet down. The implication being that I wasn't necessarily encouraging it, but it wasn't going to stop any type of attacks from happening either. Actually, incidentally, before we go any further, there had been rumors, again, of tensions for the whole year, but also in the week before, there were significant rumors of tensions as well. And in fact, the Haganah sent people to Hebron, sent about 20 soldiers to Hebron earlier that week, Monday or Tuesday of that week, offering to stay in order to provide protection for the people of Hebron, because they knew that there were tensions that were brewing in the area. So in a obviously fateful decision now, Rabbi Slonim told them that no, he has excellent relations with all of the Arab neighbors, and there's no reason for you to be here. In fact, if you're going to be here, you're going to sort of antagonize them, because what are these Jews doing here with these Jewish soldiers with guns? Right? What are they doing here? And he sent them on their way, and they left. So they were left with, you know, he said, we're good. I know all of our neighbors. We've worked together for decades. In fact, the Slonim family had been there for over 100 years. They traced their ancestry. They were Chabad Hasidim. They traced their ancestry to the Alter Rebbe, to the first Lubavitcher Rebbe, and he said, no, there's no need for you to be here. And they sent them on their way. So then Friday is when attacks did begin. There were stones began to be thrown at people, and there was an attack on the yeshiva. Now, any yeshiva guy knows that when is the most empty time of a Beis Medrash, and that is Friday afternoon. On Friday afternoon in yeshivas, there is nobody in the Beis Medrash, although in this case, there was one person in the Beis Medrash. Pull this out here. Okay. So so on Friday afternoon the angry mob started getting themselves into a riled up. The mob started to walk the streets of Hebron, and the Jews all ran into their houses, hoping to cover things up. There was a bacher who already was stabbed right then, a yeshiva bacher. He was able to get away. He was not killed. But then, when they saw all the Jews were in their houses, so then the mob said, "Well, let's go to the yeshiva. Let's try it. You know, let's go burn down. Let's go take down the yeshiva." So the they started throwing stones into the window. There was one boy there. His name was Shmuel Rosenholz. Shmuel Rosenholz. He, I believe, was American as well. He got hit with stones. He saw the stones come into the yeshiva. So he said, "I better get out of here." So he quickly runs out the door. But as soon as he runs out the door, so there was a mob that was greeting him. He tried running back in. The mob was able to grab him, stab him, and he was stabbed to death on the spot. There was another person who was in the building, the gabbai of the yeshiva, who jumped and hid into a well, and he was actually able to survive. And he was able to survive the event. So this is still, it's the middle of the summer, remember. This is already in August, so Shabbos doesn't start till 7:30, 8 o'clock. This happened, sounds like 4 o'clock in the afternoon or so. And word started, and at that point, the police came. There wasn't anyone else around to kill. Everybody else was in their houses. So the mob sort of dispersed, and a tense order was started. A tense order was sort of restored. So the yeshiva said, "Well, we have 4 hours till Shabbos. Let's bury this boy. We already have. He was just murdered. We're going to bury him this afternoon." So the British commissioner, Cafferata, said, "Whoa! You're not going to have one of these massive funerals. We're not going to allow that. We're only going to allow 6 people. I allow 6 people to go and bury him." So they took that, they accepted that, and they went and buried this boy, and then Shabbos began. Now, Shabbos was obviously so it was very tense. They were all told that they have to be in their houses, but there were some houses that were considered better than others. So a bunch of families sort of huddled together in individual houses, including the Slunim house, where it sounds like there were 30, 40 people that were there. Families had all gone. There were a few large houses where they got together. Shabbos morning, 7 o'clock, they started davening with a minyan in these houses. And about 8 o'clock or so, as they hear the Arabs in the street, and they start smashing into windows and trying to smash through doors. The Jews had fortified doors, and had put a lot of furniture behind them. So some of the houses they were able to get into, some of the houses they were not able to get into. The houses that they were able to get into, they went and they killed or maimed as many as they could. There was rape that went on. There was rape and then murder that went on. And over the course of really that morning was the death of, I believe, 62 of the people, 62 Kedoshim, plus another 150 or so that were significantly wounded. This went from house to house, as many houses they could get into. Jews tried to hide, they hid in the wells. There were some that were protected by Arab neighbors. There are some the Arabs tried to claim that these were all outsiders. These were all people from Hebron that came in here, but that was found not to be true. In fact, there was a trial that was held later on, and two of the murderers were sentenced to death. So over the course of that trial, the daughter of a 13-year-old girl whose parents were killed was asked to testify how they were killed, and she described how they were chased down alleys until eventually they were stabbed by the mob. And they said, really, could you identify the people that were that murdered them? Could you identify the people that were part of that mob? And she said, absolutely. One of them was our next door neighbor. And she went over to him and pointed him out and said, this man murdered my parents. And then she turned to him and said, like, how could you do this after all of these years? So there were certainly members of the community that did this. There were Arabs and Muslim members that protected Jews in the area. Some of them actually were killed because of that. But essentially, the Jews were unarmed. The police force was untrained and unable or perhaps unwilling to do anything. The actions of this, of Kafarada, the actions of him seem to indicate that it's not that he wanted any of this to happen, but he wasn't sure, he really didn't know how to handle it. This was somebody who was unexperienced, he didn't know the people that were there. He actually personally killed a couple of Arabs in protection of Jews, meaning when he knew that there was some type of attack that was going on someplace, he went over there, he fired into the crowd, fired above the crowd, was able to disperse the crowd, and things like that. But they were significantly outnumbered, and he didn't want to be killed himself. He didn't want the mob to turn on him, which they were certainly capable of doing. After order was somewhat restored, the Jews were all brought to the police station. Many of them were severely wounded. Many of them, I believe, something like only 50 or so were killed on the day, while another 10, 12 were killed in the weeks or so that followed due to their wounds. People there were just lying on the floor. There was blood all over the place in this police station. And the next day, they were told, okay, you have to leave. The British told the Jews, you will have to get out of here because we can't protect your safety. So they were pretty much given one day, Sunday, to collect what they can. I assume that picture that I put in the announcements, this was already 1929, so there are pictures around. I assume that picture was taken that day on that Sunday of the old elderly man leaning against, weeping against the fence. Or there's another famous picture of a pile of svarim with somebody sort of from the yeshiva with somebody sort of like sprawled out on top of it, crying about the loss of the yeshiva. But they were told that they had to leave, and they left. Buses came. The army, the British, protected them as they left town. Of course, their houses and the yeshiva were all looted and destroyed, and whatever was left. I mean, they took some Sifrei Torah. Some things weren't. There's pictures of the shuls in Hebron that existed at the time, of them being ransacked and them being destroyed. And And that was it. They were gone. The town was, at that point, was Judenrein, was empty of Jews for a little bit. The Jews that were killed there, so many of them were just left behind and were actually buried by the Arabs. They built a mass grave in the Jewish cemetery in Hebron, and they just dumped all of the bodies there. The yeshiva in Hebron suggests, so in this book here, it tells the story of three of the rabbanim. So two of them, for reasons of hashgacha pratis, were not there in town. They were there's a lot of material in here if you are interested in seeing the material. It lists all the people of the yeshiva that were killed, but the so the Rosh Yeshiva, he was in town at the time, Rav Moshe Mordechai Epstein. So he was saved because he actually was neighbors with Officer Caparata, the one who was in charge. He lived next door to them, and apparently his daughter and wife knew English somehow. I'm not really understanding how they knew English, but apparently they knew English, and this Caparata was very lonely. he had nobody in town to talk to. So he actually befriended these people. Now, he'd only been there for a couple of weeks, but at least he had befriended this group. It talks to you about Caparata's wife, but in the other book, it says that Caparata had a girlfriend or something that wasn't in town. But anyways, as they were going around killing, so the Epstein sort of, again, like everybody else, just tried putting things in front of the door in order to protect it. They had said Shema Yisrael, and all of a sudden they hear gunshots, and all of a sudden the Arabs left. So what happened? So apparently his wife / girlfriend, whatever this woman was, he saw this mob gathering around the Rosh Hashiva's house, and she ran all over the city looking for her husband. Finally, she got a hold of him, told him, you know, do what you can. He's like, so he galloped over there, and as he got there, he shot a couple of shots into the air, and was able to scare the mob away, and the Rosh Hashiva's family was therefore saved. Rabbi Cheskel Sarna, who was his son-in-law, he was his son-in-law and became the Rosh Yeshiva of Hebron a couple of years later. So he happened to not be in town because he was going to go back, but then he was told they convinced him not to. I think there's some story about how and then the Rav Simcha Zissel Broyd, who became the leader, he was just a bachar at the time, a young boy at the time, but apparently he had hired a cab to take him back to Hebron, and the cab driver found him on Friday and told him, I'm not taking you because there's disturbances down there. So, and here's your money back. So he took the money. He's like, what do you mean? I'm going. I got to go back to yeshiva. So he went and found something else, somebody else, and his parents told him, absolutely, you're not allowed to go. I think his parents told him you can't go, and therefore he stayed in town, and therefore he also was able to survive. So now this yeshiva is back in Yerushalayim. It's 1931. They had built the building and sustained themselves in Hebron, which now was entirely lost. They said we're going to rebuild. So they rebuilt a yeshiva for a while in Yerushalayim, in Geula. That yeshiva, I believe, still exists. They built one from one place to another. There is a yeshiva today known as Hebron Geula, which is that yeshiva. But in the 70s, they built a very large campus, a really beautiful campus in Givat Mordechai. So, if you go to Grus, if you've ever been to the Grus Kollel in Bayit Vegan, or really, half of Bayit Vegan, if you're on the right side of the mountain, so the mountain of Bayit Vegan faces Givat Mordechai. So right on the other side of the mountain, you could see a building, a very large building with arches. So that's what became known as Hebron Yeshiva Knesset Yisrael. That was the yeshiva sort of rebuilt itself there. I don't recall ever being in a base medrash large. When I stayed in Gris for Shabbos, I went to daven there on Shabbos morning. I'm not sure I'd ever been in a base medrash as large as that one. It was just huge. I mean, it was tall and huge and large, and there weren't even pillars in the middle. Like, I wasn't even sure how the beams were able to keep the whole, to keep the ceiling up. And today it's known as one of the top yeshivas in Israel. There, I actually have some friends from America who still go there, but never really established itself at, you know, most Americans Americans go to Mir and then to Brisk, most don't end up in Chevron. Chevron is considered to be a sort of a younger yeshiva, meaning right after high school, so you try to get into Chevron. Mir is usually for more advanced students, and most Americans, when they're going to Mir, they're already... I think I was being asked about this shiur. So the yeshiva continues. The town of Chevron, they attempted to resettle it. I'm not exactly what the story was, but in the 30s, they actually attempted to go back to Chevron and resettle it. There were a couple dozen families, I think, that were able to go back to Chevron, but then there were disturbances in 1936, and the British came and kicked them out. There were a couple stragglers that stayed behind. There's one person, a Jew, who stayed behind, who left in 1948, and then from 1948 to 1967, so the town of Chevron was Judenrein. The town of Chevron was empty of Jews for that period, which some suggest for the first time in hundreds and thousands of years that Jews were not able to live in Chevron. They came back in 1967, running out of time, but there's a wild story that Rabbi Goren tells in his memoirs, that he, or Rav Goren, was at the liberation of Yerushalayim. So I believe the next of the Kotel, I believe the next day is they got the orders to go and go to Chevron. So he said, "I'm going to Chevron." And I think the general wasn't so thrilled about him going. And it seems like they didn't wake him up. let's not tell the rabbi we're leaving. And all of a sudden he wakes up and nobody's around. So he got his driver and said, "All right, we're going." And they just drove straight to Chevron, and all of a sudden he's getting there, and his driver says, "Rabbi Goren, it appears that the army isn't here yet." And he said, "Doesn't matter, keep going. And he drove into Chevron, and everybody had white sheets out and white flags out. There was no defense. He said, apparently he gave a pep talk the night before to the troops, saying that, you know, "We need to go to Chevron because we have to redeem, you know, because of the massacres that took place in 1929, we have to redeem the city. And also because of the Gush Emunim," talk about this a different time, "but the Gush Emunim, right before, in 1948, when there was the massacre of the people at Gush Emunim, that area, so they, right before they declared the state, so apparently the Arabs that carried out that massacre had come from Chevron. So he said, "We need to avenge their death," but it's not like he went around killing everybody, and he just drove into town, and that was it. And everybody surrendered to him. And he actually went to Maras HaMachpelah by himself. Like, apparently there were Arabs that were huddled in there afraid that the Jews were going to come, and they had locked themselves in, and he's like, "Let me in." And he got in, and he reestablished, you know, he was the first one back into Chevron in 1967. The town, the bodies were buried in the old cemetery in Chevron, which still exists today to some extent. They were, you're put into a mass grave, but there are accusations of mutilations that went on, which apparently, I don't know why that makes it so much worse, but apparently there were accusations of mutilations, so they went back, they got permission to go back 2 weeks later to rebury, reinter those that had been killed. But they, after reinterring 20 bodies, they realized that the bodies had already decayed to the point that we're not going to be able to figure anything out. So there was a monument that was put up. It's unclear to me if the monument that is there, where they put all the yeshiva boys together, if that is the same monument that existed then. I'm not sure when that was put up. During the interim from 48 to 67, the Arabs destroyed the cemetery, or at least built on the cemetery and planted on the cemetery. They took all the stones away from the cemetery. In fact, you could see in built, like you see in Europe sometimes, that the stones are used for walls. You can see it in Chevron as well. I remember when I went to Chevron, they pointed that out, that some of the tombstones were used used for Arab buildings. There was a minhag, an old minhag in Hebron, of not marking the graves, of just having stones but not actually names on the stones. And there were maps of where various people were buried. That's there's theories about why that would be, but but not for now. So the cemetery had sort of gotten destroyed. In 1975, however, there was a woman who lived in Hebron. The Jews had already gone back and lived there. And there was a woman, maybe I'll send you to the Hebron website, where it tells the story of this woman who had a child who died at the age of 6 months, just died in his crib, and said, I'm going to bury him in the cemetery, and took him to the cemetery, and the army was actually put in charge to stop her, and she's like, she just held her baby, her dead baby, and said, I'm walking, and the army's like, all right, we're not going to stop her, and she just continued to go. So she actually tells that story in English on the Hebron website, so in a YouTube. So you could take a look there. Just two quick, divrei Torah to share. Three quick divrei Torah to share, if we could get them in the next couple of minutes. Number one, there was a story, the famous story, 6 months later, they had, that afternoon, apparently, Rav Cook, Rav Avraham Yitzchak HaKohen Cook, found out what was going on and went to the head in Yerushalayim, to the name that we mentioned before, and said, you have to go protect the Jews. They're being killed there. And he said, well, I can't. I don't have orders. It's against my orders. I don't have orders to go. And Rav Cook said, what do you mean you don't have orders? I have orders to you on behalf of all moral people to go and save these people. And he didn't really do anything. So about a month or two later, Rav Cook was invited to some kind of affair for just some kind of banquet that he needed to go to. And this officer from the British officer stuck out his hand to shake his hand, and Rav Cook refused to shake his hand. He says, "I will not shake a hand that holds Jewish blood." And this became a major deal and major machlokas, really, whether Rav Cook did the right thing by sort of annoying this British general. But Rav Cook held his ground. There's in the Rav Cook biography, there's an interesting story about how he. About how this sort of got resolved eventually, but Harry Luke, that was his name, and he pushed through. 6 months later, they actually held a memorial service in the Yeshurun Synagogue at that time that Rav Cook spoke, that he gave a hesped about it, as well as Rav Moshe Mordechai Epstein, he gave a hesped as well. Rav Cook wrote at that time, Rav Cook in his Hesped said that we have no doubt that the martyrs of Hebron, we're going to remember them. We're going to remember the pogrom. We're going to remember the fact that the Arabs attacked us, but we have to make sure to also remember Hebron. That was what Rav Cook said. You have to remember this place called Hebron and not turn our backs on it, and we have to strive to be able to go back there. That was his comment. Rav Slonim, actually, Rav Yaakov Yosef Slonim, this father who lost many of his children that day. He also spoke at this, and Rav Moshe Mordechai Epstein spoke there as well. Rav Moshe Mordechai Epstein said that I have not stopped grieving. He says, why have I not stopped grieving? So similar to when when Yaakov didn't stop grieving for Yosef, so he didn't stop grieving for Yosef because he saw within Yosef that Yosef is going to be the next leader of the Jewish people. And then all of a sudden, Yosef is dead. So that's why he did it. He wasn't crying because a father lost his son. He was crying because Klal Yisrael had lost its leader. And then Yosef was found to be alive. So Rav Epstein said, so I'm not crying just as a Rebbe who lost his Talmidim. I'm crying as a person who lost Klal Yisrael, because the people that were killed that day, many of them knew Shas many times over. They were brilliant. They were Talmidim. They're going to be the leaders of the next generation. And then I'll just share one more story that is told here in this book as well. There's a Mishpacha magazine article that I came across a year ago, that goes through the Americans that were killed. And it actually tells a quick story of actually the one from Philadelphia. His name was Zev Berman. He had actually gone to YU, graduated, had a smicha, went to Hebron, and apparently was a very good speaker. Actually beat the Skokie Yeshiva in a debate when he was in college. They had a debating, which is, I'm not sure how they got together with the, they couldn't do it over Zoom. That was quite a trip. But he beat them in the debate, and his father said something about, I'm very happy that my son's a good speaker and can debate well, but I'd really rather him just be able to learn Shas. Yeah, and he went off to Hebron to learn, ultimately, and was killed in the riots. But he tells actually two, two really good important stories that are mentioned here in this Mishlacha magazine article. One is that there was a fundraiser that would go to Chicago, and apparently there's a wealthy person in Chicago, the Wexler family, and he told the Wexler family, he convinced one of his children to go learn in Hebron. And there's a very wealthy family. The son went to learn in Hebron. Apparently he was killed in Hebron. This boy was killed in Hebron. So this fundraiser, he didn't want to go to Chicago anymore because he didn't want to see the father, because he felt responsible that he had sent this son to Hebron. And, what was the father? The father would hold it against him. So a couple of years later, he actually ran into the father in Manhattan. And the father said, why don't you come to Chicago anymore? He said, well, the truth is, I'm afraid to face you because I feel responsible that I convinced you to send your kid to Hebron. And he was killed. And the father said, he said, no. He said, there's no reason for you. You did a great favor for him because Hashem had decided that he was going to be killed. He was going to die on Yud Tes Av in 1929. Wherever he was going to be, that was what was going to happen. So had he stayed in Chicago, he would have died in a car accident. Instead, he went to Hebron and was able to die al kiddush Hashem. Was able to die as one of them, as a bnei yeshiva of the Slabodka yeshiva, and be able to die al kiddush Hashem. And just one more that's at the end of this Mishpacha magazine article. The head of the fundraiser, the head of the people that tried to raise money for the Hebron yeshiva was Yaakov Schiff, who was a very wealthy Jew in America. And then he lost all of his money. He lost a lot of his empire with the crash in the recession. He really had no money left. So he met the Rosh Yeshiva as he came to Rav Sarna, who came to America to raise money for the yeshiva in the early 30s. And he went to meet. He saw Schiff. He said, I understand you can't help us anymore. Perhaps the yeshiva. I'm willing to lend you money against the yeshiva's mortgage in order to just get you back on your feet. To which Harry Schiff, when he responded by saying, he says, absolutely not. He started crying, and he says, you don't understand. See, I once owned all of this real estate. I owned so much real estate in this world, and I owned all of that, and that's testified to me. The only thing I have left now is the Hebron Yeshiva, is the money I gave for that. And now you're going to take that away from me as well. He said, I can't take that money. That's the only thing that I have left from all of the empire that I once had. So that is some of the story. This is certainly included. This happened right after Tisha B'Av, but it's certainly included in many of the difficulties that we have passed over the years. There's a lot to say about this, what this led to. This was sort of a turning point in the Israel Arab. They realized that they're just not going to be able to get along, and that ultimately sort of led towards 1948. But this is one of the things that we remembered during this time. Okay, Mincha is about to start, so we'll stop here.
Was it really a car accident? Or he said he would have died.
No, he said he would have died in a car accident. Was